Anna. It's 1 p.m. Media Matters with Bob McChesney is next.
All right, greetings. Welcome to Media Matters today. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here on WILL AM 580 in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. We've got a live show for you today on July 17th. And our guest today is going to be someone who's been a guest on the show many times before, most recently, I believe, in February. One of the outstanding broadcast journalists of the past few decades, and now one of the leading media critics and journalists and filmmakers in the United States, Danny Schechter, our guest today on Media Matters. But first, let's go to Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news relating to the intersection of media and democracy. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Kimberly Cronick.
It was a bona fide grilling on Capitol Hill as Corporation for Public Broadcasting Chairman Kenneth Tomlinson faced a bipartisan third degree at a Senate Appropriations Subcommittee hearing on July 11th. Tomlinson first faced criticism from Illinois Democrat Senator Dick Durbin about his crusade against the program Now and its host, Bill Moyers. Tomlinson spent tens of thousands of dollars on questionable contracts to monitor Now and other programs for signs of liberal bias. Not that the research these so-called monitoring reports produced was worth the paper they were scribbled on.
He was paid thousands of dollars. His data, riddled with spelling errors, was faxed to you from a Hallmark store in downtown Indianapolis.
It's like Bob Dylan said, you know, you don't need to weather vane to see which way the wind's blowing. It was very clear that the Moyers program was liberal advocacy journalism. I wanted a statistical basis because I didn't think people were responding appropriately.
Moyers would like to debate Tomlinson publicly about conservative complaints with public broadcasting. After some prodding by Senator Arlen Specter, Republican of Pennsylvania, Tomlinson agrees to one in principle, but would rather not have to.
Now, this thing between Mr. Moyers and me could be a lot of fun. We would have a lot of fun debating on television for an hour about that. It would not be good for public television, and I think Mr. Moyers and I both agreed that in recent weeks we didn't think it was in the interest of public broadcasting for us to continue.
Do you think it would be a lot of fun?
It would be a lot of fun.
Well, do you think it ought to be broadcast on Saturday Night Live?
That's probably where it belongs.
Alaska Republican Ted Stevens thinks Tomlinson's bias crusade has hurt NPR and PBS, leading in part to recently proposed cuts of more than $100 million to the federal CPB budget, cuts public broadcasting cannot afford.
Members said that Congress ought to calm down. This system needs our support. I deplore the fact that there's some people within it that want to exercise their political bias in delivering it. I think the board's problem is to get rid of that and restore the balance that existed in the past in this system.
The full Senate's expected to vote on the spending bill containing the public broadcasting provisions later this summer. In the interim, the Inspector General at the Corporation for Public Broadcasting has opened an investigation into how CPB's new president, Patricia Harrison, was hired for the job. CPB Chair Tomlinson streamlined the hiring process so as to position Harrison as the top candidate. Harrison has a long history as a State Department propagandist and is a former chair of the Republican National Committee. This joins an ongoing probe into Tomlinson's misguided bias and balance crusade.
Eventually, this round of political fireworks over public broadcasting will end. Where will PBS and NPR be then? Better or worse for wear? There will still be funding shortfalls and partisan pressure, which over the last 10 years has especially taken its toll on public television, according to Jerry Starr, executive director of Citizens for Independent Public Broadcasting.
Public television in England and France and Germany and Italy, the Netherlands, Norway, Sweden and Spain attract audience shares of between 33% and 49%, with Denmark at 69%. PBS claims 3%.
Dr. Ernest Wilson agrees that something drastic must be done. But Wilson, who's been a member of the CPB Board of Directors since 2000, says the problem is one of demographics.
You know, we really have those eyeballs between 1 year old and 7 years old, and then we lose them for the next 40 years. And so we have, you know, the 47 on crew. We have got to find a way to get more audiences between the ages of 8 and 46. And that's certainly going to involve some reforms to the current system of deciding what goes on the air and making it more responsive to diverse perspectives.
One thing you won't hear out of Washington is the notion of fundamental reform to the public broadcasting system. While proposals exist to create an independent trust fund for public broadcasting purposes, Wilson says they have no momentum to speak of.
You cannot expect the Congress on its own, you cannot expect the boards of these organizations to be really in the forefront and think outside the box. It's got to come from the grassroots.
To that end, several groups, including Free Press, are planning a series of nationwide public meetings in hopes of engaging local public radio and TV stations in dialogue about bottom-up reform.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a joint production of the Illinois Initiative for Media Policy Research at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization dedicated to media democracy. For more information, visit our website at freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Okie dokie, welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you today live, July 17th, 2005, on WILL AM 580 in Campbell Hall on the campus of the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today, our guest is Danny Schechter, founder and executive editor of MediaChannel.org. Danny's a television producer, independent filmmaker, and media critic. He's written several books, including The More You Watch, The Less You Know, and Embedded, The Weapons of Mass Deception, How the Media Failed to Cover the War on Iraq. He is the co-founder and executive producer of Global Vision, a New York-based television and film production company. Danny has a long and storied career in journalism. He was a producer for CNN and a producer for ABC's 2020, where he won two National News Emmys. His writing has appeared almost everywhere. It is our honor to have Danny Schechter joining us today. Danny, are you there?
Great to be with you. Absolutely.
Well, thank you so much.
And moreover, I'm always interested to know that I have a storied career.
You indeed do have a story, many stories. You know, I think our listeners are well aware of you, your background. You've been a guest many times. One of the reasons we wanted to get you on the show, let's just start right there. You just were in Europe, were you not, covering the G8?
Correct, I was.
One of the problems with our media system is that the G8 doesn't get necessarily a lot of attention here, a lot of sustained analysis. What is the G8? Why is that important? Why were you covering it?
First of all, you know, here you have the President of the United States together with the leaders of the industrial world, so to speak, you know, the Japanese, the Canadians, you know, the French, the Italians. I mean, these are the big players in the West anyway. And, you know, they have these conferences which outside the UN system, outside any sort of accountable institutional framework to basically come to decisions about how they're going to coordinate their strategies and attempt to, you know, retain their dominance in the world. So the G8 meetings have been very important, which is why they've been sort of targeted by anti-globalization protesters, one of whom died, if you recall, some years back in Genoa in Italy, mm-hmm. Demonstrating against the G8. So the G8 meetings, which also have taken place in the United States and Calgary and elsewhere, is an annual sort of get-together, you know, of the more powerful nations and their advisors and the people who they do business with. And, of course, that also attracts the attention of activists and the like. Now, this time around, there was an interesting difference because this time around it was being hosted by Tony Blair in Britain. And Blair had decided to make Africa and aid to Africa and debt relief for Africa his key issue, partly many suspect in Britain to change his image from being a sort of warmonger supporter of Bush and the like to being somebody who has an independent foreign policy, who cares about the world, et cetera, and so forth. So Tony Blair essentially enunciated these principles, and they formed a commission on Africa. This is before the G8 met, mm-hmm. and an organization called Make Poverty History, which was an NGO-driven organization, non-governmental groups behind it. But the British government helped fund it funding Oxfam and other organizations. So the Bush, the Blair administration was really orchestrating this in many ways and supporting it. And they also basically supported the Live Aid concerts, which was Bob Geldof and Bono and the like. And the idea was, we're going to try to get the G8 leaders to make a real commitment to debt relief for the poorest countries in the world, more aid, and better trade relations with Africa. That was the key points of the summit, although there were, of course, other issues, security issues and others that were being discussed. So it attracted a lot of attention, and I was invited up to Edinburgh in Scotland to the G8 Alternative Summit, which was run by the various political groups and NGO organizations, to monitor what was going to happen at the G8, to discuss different political positions on what should be done there. And this followed, you know, a march in Edinburgh that drew 250,000 people, which was very impressive because it was young and old. It was very active political activists and, you know, old line political activists and socialist groups and the like, and also church organizations, people who usually don't turn out the demonstrations. And there were some splits there with the Stop the War movement, which had mobilized 1 million people in England against the war, really being sort of pushed out of the coalition, being told that they really couldn't march in it with their own banners, couldn't participate in the main rally. So they had a sort of separate rally there. At any rate, I came a day before I was to speak there and took part in the march and took part in the rally and found it really fascinating. Because of not only what was said, but what wasn't said. There was a lot of concern among even the make poverty history people that they were being co-opted in some way, that the Blair administration, basically had co-opted the African issue. They weren't really going to deliver on it, but it appeared as if they were. And, of course, they made an announcement before the G8 that they were going to eliminate the debt of many countries. Now, many of these countries can't afford to pay the debt anyway and haven't been paying it, but that really wasn't reported on very much.
We're talking to Danny Schechter today, Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We do have phone lines open. If you want to call in with a question or comment for Danny Schechter, 344-9455 is our local number. Toll free, 1-800-222-9455. Danny Schechter is well known, I think, to many of our listeners. He's the founder and executive director of MediaChannel.org, a mandatory website for those interested in media issues and interested in global politics. He's a television producer, journalist, filmmaker. A renaissance man of media activism, I think, is a fair way to put it. Danny, how would you characterize the press coverage of the demonstrations and the G8 events in the United States compared to what was taking place in Europe?
Well, of course, I wasn't here in the U.S., but I did tune in, occasionally to CNN, occasionally to find out what was happening in the States and on the coverage. In Britain, because Tony Blair was behind this whole Africa issue, Africa suddenly, was drenched in coverage in a way that one had never seen before. BBC was doing a whole week of special primetime programs on African problems. Channel 4 originated their newscast live from Uganda, unheard of, to highlight the problems of AIDS and other African issues. There was a real way in which the media in Britain took this very seriously and focused a lot of attention on it. Now, this contrasted sharply from the American media, which did not do that, and in part because this is something that the Bush administration in this country was really, downplaying, was not really interested in Africa, and was only pushed to take a higher profile stand by Bono, by a lot of public pressure on the Bush administration. So I think the coverage here was very superficial and thin, as it is on most issues about the world, and has been for many years. And this is a very frustrating thing, because obviously you have millions of people, dying of AIDS. You have a whole continent which is, living in many cases, with on $1 or $2 a day, and, basically out of the glaze of the American media system. And this is partly because economic issues, economic interests, who's really doing what, in terms of following the money, in terms of world affairs, is very, not covered very well in our media. As a result, most Americans know more about personalities. Bono is making a statement, or there's a big rock concert and all the like, but they don't know much about the politics behind it, and nobody tells them about it. And that's the problem. That's why I went and I wrote about it for Media Channel. Many other websites picked up my reports. You know, I feel like it's a very important issue. I've been working and involved in Africa for many years. I was very involved in the anti-apartheid movement and covering what was happening in South Africa. I just came back from South Africa just a few weeks ago. So, you know, I was very sensitized to these issues. So on the one hand, I was really delighted to see so much coverage in Britain, but really dismayed at the lack of coverage in America. And then as it became clear that the Blair proposals were pretty superficial, that they were avoiding dealing, let's say, with trade issues and making any real progress on trade, and that the aid was being stretched out over 5 years, where the UN on their Millennium Goals says, hey, we need $50 billion a year to help Africa catch up to the rest of the world. They were offering $50 billion over 5 years. So, you know, a lot of people were feeling it was too little, too late, that the opportunity for a classic historic breakthrough was passed, in part because there wasn't, you know, enough understanding in the public about the real underlying issues. And that's where media and politics really interconnects. If people understand an issue, if they understand the context, the background, they're more likely, you know, to follow the issue carefully and care about it. When they don't, when it's not explained in any kind of meaningful way, they tend not to care about it.
Danny Schechter, I want to talk a bit about the bombings in London and how they were covered and their significance. But before we do that, let's go stay with Africa for a while, because you're right. You've been covering Africa for a long time. You had a program on PBS that dealt with human rights issues in South Africa, a famous program. Africa gets very little press coverage in the United States. Most Americans know next to nothing about Africa. What would you say are the big stories that are taking place in Africa, news stories that ought to be covered in this country that aren't getting covered?
Well, let's just contrast this a little bit, because other countries where, you know, American Jews, they're, you know, are a small percentage of the American people. Israel is covered, you know, every single day in most media outlets. More Americans know about Israel than almost any other foreign country. More U.S. aid goes to Israel than many other countries, although Egypt gets its share also for parity and the like. However, Africa, where you have, you know, millions of African Americans, people who were forced here from Africa, Africa doesn't exist, and that's largely because of the racial composition of the American media, and because it tends to, you know, be much more interested in what the American government, American companies are doing than on what is actually happening, you know, in Africa. So, you know, there you have an imbalance right there. You know, it can be covered, it isn't. Mm-hmm. What are the big issues there? Well, you know, the struggle for development, the struggle to try to pull a country out of poverty and to be able to be part of the world, to trade with the world, you know, to deal with one of the most ravaging pandemics in the world, the AIDS pandemic, diseases like malaria, which are rarely, if ever, covered or mentioned. I mean, our company did a report on malaria, and, you know, we couldn't find any news outlet to carry it in the United States. It was picked up around the world. It wasn't picked up in the United States at all. And here you have a million children dying a year from malaria. Nobody here knows that. And it's a curable disease. It's something that something can be done about, but it gets virtually no coverage. So there is this imbalance. And, you know, in South Africa itself, you know, you saw, first of all, the excitement of a country 10 years on trying to build a democracy with a lot of different cleavages and contradictions and the like, a fascinating test tube, you know, of both the limits of development and the pressures and restraints on development, you know, happening there. Nelson Mandela in his the sunset of his years, you know, an effort to try to break out of the world trading system to some degree, and it's not even, you know, taken seriously in most of the American media, and that's discouraging. And actually, you know, one of the things that was most discouraging was that the South African media, television, South African broadcasting, tends to want to, like, ape American broadcasting. So it has more, you know, kind of similarities to American TV. When I got off the plane in Durban, South Africa, my film, WMD, was being shown in the film festival in Durban and actually won the top prize there, to my surprise.
Congratulations, Danny.
To my surprise, when I got off the plane, the first thing I saw, okay, was a big billboard announcing that Desperate Housewives is coming to South Africa. The second thing I saw was that there was a local version of the Donald Trump, you know, a program in South Africa featuring as the star of it a former leader, a former freedom fighter, somebody who had been in prison in Robben Island, Tokyo Saswali, was now playing Donald Trump on a local version, you know, of his, you know, You're Fired, you know, TV show. And so, you know, this was sort of bizarre to me, you know, how American cultural influence is very dominant. At the same time, South Africans, if they make T-shirts, they can't sell them in the United States because of World Trade Organization restrictions and the African Trading Act, which was passed, that only allows for, you know, a privatization and all the rest of it. None of us know about this.
We're talking to Danny Schechter today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580. This is a live show coming to you July 17th, 2005. Feel free to call in with questions if you have them. The number here is 1-800-222-9455. That's our toll-free number. And our local lines, 344-9455. Danny Schechter, as many of you know, a storied journalist we've now established, has just come back from Europe, where he was covering the G8 and the demonstrations. Were you there for the bombings in London?
I left London 2 days before the bombings, when I was actually at the, you know, King's Cross Station. I was actually, you know, in the underground. And, you know, I noticed, one of the things I noticed there was the proliferation of, you know, closed-circuit TV cameras all over London that I had never seen before. And I was kind of aware of this. And also the big debate in the British press was about the issuing of a national ID card. You know, we spent many years fighting against the pass system in South Africa, where everybody had to carry a card. Now, in London, it looks like they're going to be introducing that in England, and they were debating it before the bombings, and there was a lot of opposition to it. I'll bet you that opposition has shrunk quite a bit now because of fear. At any rate, I left 2 days before, but I've been following it very closely, and it's, you know, obviously very disturbing. But one of the factors here that did get covered, but several days after the event, you know, in the New York Times, is the extreme alienation of people, of young people of color, in the towns in the north of England, like Liverpool, where these alleged bombers came from, and other communities.
Leeds, I believe.
Leeds, rather. Yeah, where there's been fierce, you know, incidents of racism and conflict with the local police, with right-wing groups and the like. And so there's a lot of, you know, anger in that community. Now, some of it obviously has expressed itself, if we're to believe what we're reading, and I, you know, often a caution there because we can't always believe what we read, you know, that some of these young people who are very smart, apparently very upwardly mobile, worked in local community schools and the like, you know, have become basically bombers and expressing their, you know, anger and frustration that way.
We're talking to Danny Schechter today in Media Matters. Danny, we're taking callers. The problem we're facing is we've got you on a different line than usual because of some technical hang-ups. So today, for the first time in Media Matters history, when people call in, we're just going to write up their questions, and I'm going to present them to you. Yeah, well, this is actually a benefit for those listeners who are too shy to be on the air but have always wanted to ask questions. Now they can call them in, give them to our crack production team and their Andrew Boyle, ready, willing, and able at the keyboard to hammer out the question and get it to me. We've already had one caller call in with this new program to see how this works. I think this is a one-time-only offer. I think we'll be back to normal next week. So this is your big chance, those shy people out there who want to ask their questions. Robert from San Francisco telephoned and is very interested in the Valerie Plame debate, the Karl Rove issue. And, you know, what is your take on, you know, this is a complex issue. There's a lot of different things going on here. What is your assessment of the Judith Miller, you know, lock up, so to speak, Karl Rove issue? How has this played out? How has the press covered it? What are the real issues at stake here?
Well, you know, first of all, now that the press is involved in it directly, I think the coverage is beginning to improve. In other words, the Times has become a lot more aggressive on the story now that one of their reporters, their star reporters, you know, has gone to jail. And there's a tremendous amount of both fear and loathing in parts of the media because of feeling that here's a prosecutor has not disclosed what he's doing, why he's doing what he's doing, what he's after, and, you know, is basically treating journalists as if they're criminals. And in the case of Judith Miller, of course, she's somebody who did not write on the story, but nevertheless, you know, has been, in a sense, become the poster girl, if you will, the poster boy, whatever you call it, of the symbol of journalistic freedom. Ironic also because, of course, she's the journalist that was most criticized at the New York Times for her coverage of the war that tended to accept in the run-up to the war the logic of the administration, particularly on weapon systems. So now we have Judith Miller in the middle of all of this, one of the most right-wing columnists for many years, Robert Novak, who either did or did not rat out everybody else to the prosecutor. We don't know what he did. He's refusing to discuss it. There have been reports that he did meet with prosecutors and did tell them everything he knew. You have Karl Rove, the president's top advisor, Bush's brain, as he's known, in the middle of this, now acknowledging after denying it that, yes, he spoke with Novak, yes, he talked to other reporters, but he didn't say what they say he said. So, you know, it's a riddle within an enigma, without real clarity about it. And, of course, on the one hand, it's really great for people who are critical of this administration to watch them squirm, to watch them evade and avoid the issues and split hairs about whether Valerie Plame was an operative overseas or not, or whether she's covered by this Intelligence Protection of Identities Act or not, and the rest. And there's calls for impeachment, that you see on the internet among many activist groups and the like. But I think the reality is it's not really a legal issue. It's a political issue. I'm kind of amused to see people on the left, suddenly the sanctity of the names of CIA agents is suddenly holy. We suddenly agree with President Bush, who signed that law, somehow our CIA must be protected. Other people are saying that, in fact, what the leaks were really about was to try to discredit the CIA. The administration was trying to neutralize the CIA and put in its own intelligence operation, alongside the CIA that would be more loyal, if you will, to the White House. So, it's very complicated.
Well, Jane, let me ask you one thing. Do you think Judith Miller should be behind bars now for refusing to divulge her sources, or do you think there should be a federal law protecting her in that sort of relationship?
I think you can have both things. I think you can have a SHIELD Act. And I think you can also say, okay, Judith Miller, even though nobody that I know trusts her or respects her necessarily, I've met her and talked to her, she's a very hardworking, very driven, journalist. She's also, in my experience, pretty conservative. But nevertheless, she basically stood up for one of the key principles of journalism. You don't disclose your sources, or at least when you promise somebody you won't disclose their identity, you stand up for that agreement. And she's done so, and I think I have to support her in this. I have to say, yes, it's an act of civil disobedience on her part, but I support her. I don't feel that she should be in jail, at least not for this.
Speaking of this, and that leads to my next point, we're talking to Danny Schechter, by the way, today, Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Phone lines open, 344-9455 is our local number, 1-800-222-9455, our toll-free. And today, if you do call in, we'll transcribe your question, and I'll read it over the air. We're having some mix-ups with our phone system, so please bear with us. But this is a chance for those of you who are shy to get a question on the air and not have to actually be on the air yourself if you don't want to. Danny, you wrote the book Embedded: Weapons of Mass Deception, How the Media Failed to Cover the War in Iraq, did the documentary of similar name. You've been covering the coverage of the Iraq War as closely as just about anyone. What is your sense, first of all, of what's going on in Iraq today from the way you devour the international news? And then what's your sense of how we're getting it presented to us in the mainstream media in the United States, and if there's a discrepancy between the two?
And then
finally, just to finish up to make sure we get to this, can you talk a little bit about the Istanbul tribunal that's been taking place the last couple of weeks?
Right. Well, first, point one, on the whole question of my books and stuff, I've actually just finished a new book called When News Lies, which is a, kind of an update on the whole Iraq war, and it's going to come out from Select Books with a copy of the DVD of WMD, my film, in it. So you'll be able to read the script, you'll be able to read some of the commentary on the film, as well as my own take and experience and what happens when you try to make a film to challenge the media system and what kind of response you get. So that might be interesting for people who follow this to want to check out When News Lies, coming out at the end of the summer.
Now, where can they go to find out more about that, what they want to do that, Danny?
Well, the Select Books has a website, mediachannel.org, will give you information.
Okay, just remember mediachannel.org, listeners.
Once I have it, I'll be out there, hawking it as best I can.
I don't doubt that for a second.
But as far as the war coverage goes, there's a narrative in explaining. People have to understand it. Journalism, we used to think journalism was about facts, all the facts, just the facts, ma'am, kind of attitude. So we've gone from a fact-based system to a faith-based system. The faith-based system basically is you accept the narrative of the president, the support our troops, the, conservative media, or you look for another narrative and that is more critical of that one. And what's happened now is that public opinion, which supported the war, supported the president, supported the troops, is now beginning to move. And public opinion is now at the point where, 55 to 65%, depending on who you read, are saying, hey, maybe the Iraq war wasn't such a good idea. They're beginning to break with the policy, challenge the policy. We saw this during the Vietnam War. They're beginning to say the costs are too high. And, of course, the more the administration says we're winning, the insurgency is under control, et cetera, we hear reports, as we did today, 58 people dead in another dramatic incident inside Iraq. So, obviously, they don't have it under control, and the war is being lost, in terms of at least the American terms, and the insurgency there, which always is, has this sort of faceless. All we hear from the insurgency is, we see the victims of bombings. Nobody's ever interviewed. We never get any background information about who these people are or why they're fighting. They've now formed an actual political organization, a resistance. Many of the main groups, which are all Iraqi, by the way, not foreign fighters, are now enunciating, the demands. Of course, their main demand is for the U.S. to withdraw. But and the administration has leaked in various ways that they're actually negotiating with or talking to people in the insurgency after insisting they will never talk to terrorists and the like. Richard Clark, the former terrorism coordinator, has an article in the New York Times today basically saying, the Bush administration said we either fight them, in Baghdad or we fight them in Brooklyn, kind of attitude.
Mm-hmm.
He's saying, well, that really hasn't proven to be true. Look at the London bombings. Look at all these incidents going on. We've actually increased terrorism in Iraq. And, of course, the focus on the foreign fighters, Zakawi, this mysterious figure, is if you look at all these reports, half of them are different than the other half. It seems like more propaganda than truth, and it's very hard to trust these reporting. And of course, when Iraqis hear you say about when the Iraqis arrest about the foreign forces, they say, yeah, what about that's the Americans? Let's get rid of them, So and now the most recent report is Seymour Hersh and the New Yorker is coming out with a report basically saying that Bush administration wanted to fund individual politicians in the elections in Iraq, but at the last minute decided not to because if it was exposed, it would be a negative thing for the administration. But the article leaves open the possibility that funding was provided to political parties in Iraq. And so you have a situation now. The latest news is, Sadr, a Mehdi army, the cleric who's been opposed to the U.S. occupation, is now taking a nonviolent route. He's organizing a petition. As of last week, he had 400,000 signatures, and they expect that to go to 1 million in Iraq of people who want the U.S. to withdraw from Iraq. So, and apparently 106 members of the Iraqi parliament have also signed on to this. So the U.S. politically, may still be in charge, in control, but it's not clear that they're in charge.
Danny Schechter, you cut your teeth in the 1960s, and it's chronicled in your terrific book, The More You Watch, The Less You Know. You really were active opposing the Vietnam War in the 1960s. Do you see any comparisons between Vietnam and Iraq?
I think, you know, there are tremendous comparisons, but because, you know, the United States lost the war in Vietnam, many of the people in the American, in the Pentagon, have blamed the media for that. It's not us, it's not our policies, it's not our soldiers, it's the media. They're the ones that lost the war by souring the American people on it. And as a consequence, anytime anybody suggests, hey, this is a Vietnam deja vu all over again, people say, no, you must be crazy. No, there's no comparison whatsoever. Vietnam was in jungles. This is in deserts. How can you even suggest any similarities? And I've written about this. Of course, both wars were launched with deception. The Tonkin Bay incident in Vietnam was an invented attack on American ships by the Vietnamese, which was used to get the whole Congress to support, you know, an escalation of the war, you know, in effect a declaration of war, and it was based totally on a lie. The WMDs in Iraq, the link between Osama and Saddam, also a lie. So the origins of the war, very close to what happened in Vietnam. A few weeks ago, there was a report in the New York Times about a tunnel complex that they found in Iraq where the resistance fighters were storing, you know, weapons and all the rest of it. Hello, a tunnel complex. That's exactly what happened in Vietnam, where the Vietnamese were fighting underground, storing all their, you know, guerrilla warfare, very similar to what we're seeing now, hit-and-run attacks by, you know, by resistance fighters and the like. But these parallels have been denied or obscured because people don't want Americans to think of this like another Vietnam, because today very few people support the war in Vietnam. You know, very few people believe that it was a good idea, that we should have gone there, that, you know, it was worth the price of 50,000 American troops and millions of people in Vietnam. So yes, there are a lot of very clear you know, associations between the two.
Danny, what do you think, and I don't want to dwell on Iraq any longer because there's a lot of other issues I want to talk about, but what do you think are the chances that 3 or 5 years from now, Iraq will have a stable constitutional democracy where the United States will have bases in the country and have serious economic interests and will have a very close collegial relationship with the elected Iraqi government?
That's the desired outcome.
I know. What do you think the chances of that are based on what you've been seeing the last few years?
What I'm seeing is every time I see a government claim, you know, and everything is coming up roses, you know, later it turns out to not be true. So I can't believe that's going to happen. But there are other people in the Middle East, other players, who would like an outcome like that. They don't like this insurgency. They don't like all this volatility, all this fighting, because it can spill over into their own countries.
Mm-hmm.
And as a consequence, you know, there's a lot of interests that are trying to see, can we stabilize Iraq? Now we have to cut the Sunnis in. Can we make a deal? Can we work this out? That's what they're trying to do right now. But I think as long as you have a brutal occupation, it's not going to be possible to work it out. And I think the nature of occupation is brutal.
Yeah, and that leads to the next question. We had someone who called in, Danny. And by the way, for people who want to call in, we will take your calls, and I'll read them over the air. 344-9455 is our local number. 1-800-222-9455 is our toll-free number. This week and this week alone, we're having a special deal where you call in the call, and we write it down, and I read it over the air. This won't be happening in the future, we trust, but so this is your big chance if you're shy. We did have someone, Danny, while you were just talking, send in a question or called it in, asking if you see any comparisons between the Iraq War and the French-Algerian War from the 1950s, particularly in relation to the bombings and getting the populace behind the insurgency.
Well, I mean, you know,
and maybe you should give a little background on what the French-Algerian War is. I suspect a lot of our listeners are unfamiliar.
All right. Algeria was a colony of France, and the Algerians formed a National Liberation Front, a resistance, what was called the FLN. And the FLN was a popular organization against the French occupation. There were many people that supported it in the world and in France. The French waged a very brutal campaign to try to wipe this FNL out. There's a movie, if you haven't seen, you should see, called The Battle of Algiers.
It's a classic.
That shows how, you know, a guerrilla war started and how the French couldn't really deal with it. In fact, it was so appropriate that the U.S. Pentagon had screenings in the Pentagon of it for them to try to learn the lessons of the Algerian War. So there's a lot of back and forth there. But, you know, one of the things that happens in this kind of a war, particularly when you have people who are you know, fundamentalists. They're serving, you know, in their version of God and all the rest of it. There's a lot more brutality and murder of civilians and the like. And in Algeria more recently, where there was a uprising of the Islamic Salvation Front and the government committed many atrocities, and so did the Islamic Salvation Front. So atrocities seem to be more common, and the brutality of it is more common. So that's something that, you know, is horrific. You can basically say this is, shouldn't happen, this is terrible, just like people condemn all the suicide bombing in Palestine and Israel. But, you know, part of it is the logic of the situation, where one side has an air force and tanks and a modern army, and the other side is fighting with improvised ordnance and et cetera and so forth.
But do these terrorist activities, or whatever term someone wants to call them, you know, people blowing up buildings and killing a lot of innocent people, in a country like Iraq or in Algeria in the 1950s, do they turn the populace of the country against the occupiers, or
they turn them against the Mujahideen, as they're called, the insurgents.
Mm-hmm.
Many people who feel that the insurgents have been killing a lot of Iraqi children, they're furious about it. But you know, the whole point of the insurgency is to make the country ungovernable, to make the society so volatile that the other side has to, the dominant side, the occupying force, has to in some way negotiate or find a way out, because the price of it is just unacceptable. And that's what's happening in Iraq now. So yes, the individual incidents are horrible, but you know, the people who commit them justify them. They say, okay, if this was horrible, how come the U.S. bombed, you know, a wedding and killed 62 people, you know, 3 weeks ago, et cetera, and so forth? We're just retaliating against what they did. And then, you know, so you have this cycle of violence, this cycle of retaliation. You know, everybody's right, nobody's wrong, but nobody's left at the end of the day. And, you know, I'm somebody who tries to believe in nonviolence, you know, nonviolent outcomes. I was in the civil rights movement. We'd like not to see this violence. On the other hand, you know, the war is by nature violent, and there is a war going on, and usually wars have more than one side.
We're talking to Danny Schechter today, Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580, coming to you live July 17th, 2005, from Campbell Hall in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Danny, we had a couple callers who called in and had some questions about Africa. And one, I'll give them both to you and let you answer them as you wish. First question comes from a caller who asks, why has President Bush not fully funded his announced plans for combating AIDS in Africa? And the second question is, in light of Halliburton's no-bid contracts, et cetera, how is it reasonable that aid to Africa be held up until African nations are sufficiently transparent?
We have so much corruption. I mean, we just sentenced the head of WorldCom, Bernard Ebbers, to prison for 25 years in an $11 billion, quote, accounting scandal ripoff, okay? Talk about corruption. I don't think any country has been accused of a ripoff of $11 billion, you know? But this is selective and it's hypocritical, of course. We blame them for being corrupt. We don't look at ourselves in the same terms. But, you know, the key problem here is that there are institutions here who have an interest in keeping the system going, keeping their privileges. I mean, I was in London, as I mentioned earlier, I was at a conference at the London School of Economics, and there was a executive from a pharmaceutical company there. His company has 7,000 employees, and it's based in India. And he was making, you know, generic drugs for African AIDS, free AIDS drugs that they were willing to give away, and the pharmaceutical companies in the United States intervened with the Indian Parliament to block the giving away of generic drugs, because supposedly for patent and copyright violations, and the Indians were basically told that you won't be able to trade with the United States unless you bring this problem under control and stop this, because they were undermining, they weren't obviously making the profits that the big pharmaceutical companies were making. So generic drugs were basically stopped through the intervention of pharmaceutical companies pressuring Indian politicians. So this story is, you know, very complicated one. It's, you know, if you are, you know, in a poor community in South Africa, you can't afford to buy, you know, or get the drugs. Let's say the government gets it and gives it to you for free, fine. But you don't have the infrastructure to manage the patients. Mm-hmm. You don't have clean water. You don't have adequate nursing care. All the things that make AIDS drugs successful in America also make them unsuccessful in Africa if it's not monitored properly and the like.
Danny Schechter, we had a caller who did call in who said that he thought that you described the London bombers as well-educated, hardworking young men. He took offense at that and thinks you're out of touch.
Well, I don't know. I'm just looking at the profiles. Not that they're hardworking, but that one of them was described as somebody, you know, where people were saying, my God, I couldn't believe so-and-so did this because he was such a good guy, you know, such a good kid, et cetera, and so forth. I am not justifying this. Please hear me.
Yeah, I understand.
I could have been in that tube, you know. This is a horrific attack on innocent people. It's a tactic that I disapprove of completely. But you have to try to ask the question, why? You know, after 9/11, there were all these stories in the media beginning to emerge. You know, why do they hate us? Why the people in the rest of the world? What is their objection to the United States? Shouldn't we know that? And there were other people saying, that doesn't matter. Let's go bomb them and kill them.
Well, it seemed if you asked that question, you were accused of being sympathetic to people.
Right. You know, you have to try to understand why this is happening. Why would somebody who's a graduate of a British university or college and who's, you know, part of a middle-class family, why would he become a terrorist? You know, what is appealing about being a terrorist? Why would they join or do an act like this if, in fact, they did it, which we don't know yet. Of course, there have been no trials. There's been no formal, report given on what actually happened, like the 9/11 Commission report or whatever. So, I mean, I think all of this is something important. You know, in the United States, we are still debating 9/11.
Yeah, Danny, what did you think? I mean, I know you've looked at this. What was your sense of the 9/11 Commission report, the official report that came out, I guess, roughly a year ago?
Next Friday at the National Press Club, and I'm going to this, in Washington, there's going to be a press conference of a lot of people talking about the media role in covering 9/11. It's going to be at the press club. Cynthia McKinney, the congresswoman from Georgia, who's been leading this, is having hearings like the Downing Street hearings about this whole issue. And, you know, and I'm going to be there because I am very distrustful of a lot of the coverage. I'll tell you why. I was at an early press conference of the 9/11 Commission. They were just getting going. So people, you know, they were describing what they were going to look into. So I raised my hand. I said, excuse me, Congressman Hamilton, you know, the deputy chair of it. What about the relationship of the United States to Osama bin Laden back in the days of the fight against the Soviets in Afghanistan? Are you going to look into any of the origins between, you know, this whole relationship? Is it significant or not? I was very neutral in my question, but I just asked it. I said, shouldn't there be a little historical probe here? Congressman Hamilton said, you sound like you have an agenda. Okay? I said, you know, and he says, next question. At which point I grabbed the mic back. I said, just a follow-up, Congressman. But, you know, this is an issue that Newsweek has written about, Time Magazine has written about, a lot of people have written about it. I don't have an agenda. I would like to, my agenda is to get the facts, get the truth. I assume that was your agenda. Are you going to look into it? He said, sounds like an agenda. He comes now. It sounds like an agenda to me. Next question. Okay. And he moved on. I was just sort of dissed there. But what was striking to me was that none of the other reporters picked it up.
Yeah.
None of them said, hey, wait a minute. Don't dismiss this guy. That's a legitimate question.
So you mean the whole history of Osama bin Laden's close relationship with the United States before 9/11 is not in that report?
No, it's not in that report. And the report is basically, you know, it's like the narrative. It's like the Warren Commission report. You know, you accept it. But many people, you know, 70% of the American people never accepted it. They don't believe that Oswald acted alone. They're very suspicious of it. And the same thing is true here. Many people do not believe this approach. And, you know, if you look at the report, you looked at what happened. Here's, you know, Bush getting subpoenaed. He says he'll only come if he can bring Cheney. That you can't take any notes of what we actually said. It can't be transcribed. He's going to be treated different from every other witness. You know, Condoleezza Rice comes in. Were you warned about this? You know, she says, not really. You know, and then it turns out that, you know, there were like 6 or 10 warnings, you know, Osama bin Laden to attack U.S. And they say, well, yes, we got those, but they didn't give us the date. Therefore, we dismissed them. So What I'm saying is I don't buy all the conspiracy theories and all the rest of it, but I also don't trust the way this has been done, because the whole bombing of the whole 9/11 incident was used as a pretext for an invasion of Iraq, and Iraq had nothing to do with 9/11. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
It's like, for example, the United States had waged war on the mafia for many years, okay? But nobody ever said, let's bomb Sicily, you know? No, they said, let's have a police, you know, investigation. Let's try to crack and break the back of the mafia, which they've largely done, you know, with the RICO laws and with all these grand juries.
Yeah, they forced them onto HBO.
Exactly. The mafia has been reborn as a movie, you know, as a show business theme. But, you know, it's a real force in American life in terms of, organized crime. I think it's very minimal.
We're talking to Danny Schechter today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We've got a little less than 10 minutes left. We've got a couple questions we want to get to. Danny, one caller called in and asked us, says that most of the anti-war organizing today, this caller believes, should take place in college campuses rather than elsewhere, because the caller believes that everyone else has pretty much made up their minds. What do you think about that?
You know, the way the anti-war movement in America started under the Vietnam War was with teach-ins. It started on campuses. There were debates and discussions, people supporting the war, people opposing the war.
So they weren't just anti-war rallies. They were actually debates.
Yeah, they were debates. There was discussion. There was an effort. The problem today is that there's no discussion going on. There's no discourse. People, you know, go only to the sources of what they agree with and reject the sources they don't agree with. And as a consequence, nobody is really talking to anybody else. We don't have any discussion. MediaChannel.org, we're trying to initiate a what we call a postpartisan discourse to see if we can actually engage with, you know, conservatives and progressives to see what we agree on, if anything, and how we can work together, if at all. Now, one of the things is, like, for example, I was on a panel with somebody from AIM, Accuracy in Media, and, you know, she was very outspoken about prohibition on free speech in China and free press. I could agree with her on that. Okay,
mm-hmm.
On the FCC issue, which you know so well, you know, the NRA, National Rifle Association, mobilized its members against media concentration rules, along with a lot of progressive groups. Maybe there are areas that we can share, you know, a discourse on. I think we have to talk to people who don't agree with us. I think we have to find a way to get our voices heard and our message out into other, you know, communities, because, you know, we can feel good and right self-righteous about what we believe in, but that won't necessarily lead to change unless we can win over people who, you know, don't agree with us or don't understand what we're even saying.
Danny Schechter is our guest today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. One week from today, our guest, another live show, will be University of Illinois history professor David Roediger, who has a new book out and is one of the experts on issues of academic freedom, progressive politics, and racism in our society. I think it's going to be a terrific show, so be sure to stay tuned. July 24th, 2005, here to Media Matters. Danny, you know, we've only got a few minutes left, and I do want to spend some time now talking about what really sort of follows up on what you've just been talking about, which is the whole battle taking place over the future of public broadcasting in the United States. You, of course, have a personal history with public broadcasting and have a longstanding critique of it. So why don't you share your thoughts, if you would, on what's taking place in public broadcasting today?
I think the media reform movement has to get to the producing community, the Association of Independent Film and Video Makers, various American Documentary Association and whatnot, and to involve them in this as well, because we all have a stake in better public broadcasting. We're all facing this reality where public broadcasting is not only being, you know, taken over at the top by conservatives imposed by the Bush administration, but has already been taken over at the station level by the business community and by people who are risk adverse, who are afraid of any kind of content or ideas they don't like or feel might alienate somebody. When we did South Africa Now, there were stations that said,
yeah, we'll talk about South Africa Now, because I suspect a lot of our listeners are unfamiliar with it.
Yeah, well, this was a series that was from 1988 to 91, and the period of the fight for democracy in South Africa. Nelson Mandela was still in jail, and then he came out of jail, and, you know, the country went through this big change. But, you know, in that period, There were many stations that refused to run the program on the grounds it wasn't corporate friendly enough. When we did a human rights series, they said human rights is not a sufficient organizing principle for a TV series, unlike cooking. You know, cooking is is a sufficient organizing principle, but human rights isn't. So they were very nervous about putting anything on. And, of course, Bill Moyers' program is at the center of this whole controversy with this Kenneth Tomlinson character who is trying to use, claiming that Moyers is, you know, sort of the, has been unbalanced, left-wing, blah, 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 to try to discredit his program when his program, in its sense, was balancing the whole rest of public broadcasting. Mm-hmm. I filmed WMD. I showed it, part of it, to the president of PBS, Pat Mitchell. You know, hey, Danny, this is great. I didn't realize you could do such good work. Thanks, Pat. You know, I'm pleased you like it. Help me get it on PBS. So I went to PBS. PBS promptly rejected it. Not balanced. Why? Because it had a point of view, obviously one that they were uncomfortable with. So this is one of the problems: the public broadcasting is not performing the service it should be performing. What we have to do is mobilize public broadcasting viewers and producers, people at the station level, in a revolt against these imposed rules, but also in a campaign to transform public broadcasting, because it's not good enough to just go back to the same old bureaucrats. What we've got to do is re-energize the whole public broadcasting sector and make it more, make it more responsive, more diverse, more open to ideas that don't get seen or don't get heard in mainstream media.
You know, one of the marriages of left and right that you were talking about earlier, there's sort of one with regard to public broadcasting in opposition to it. Conservatives who argue that there's no justification for government subsidizing media competing with free market firms. And then progressives who simply say public broadcasting is atrocious, and with the internet, there's really no longer a place for it. I think Alex Coburn.
Well, I think this is completely wrong and completely bogus, you know. And, you know, what I find is that the hipper-than-thou people on the left, they're already, you know, kind of completely outside the public, you know, the popular culture debate in America. You know, it's just sort of dismissive. And I think they don't recognize how important it is to have a public broadcasting sphere in America. Look at Britain. Look at the BBC. They're trying to dismantle the BBC right now. You know, layoffs of producers have been announced. All of this is a reaction to the Hutton Report, which was part of the whole, the whole way the war debate took place within broadcasting in Britain. And, you know, this is a tremendous, it would be a tremendous loss to the world if the BBC was decapitated. And, you know, in our country, we don't even have anything like the BBC. You know, we look at the BBC, we say, wow, that's great. We'd like to have something like that, or the CBC in Canada. We can do so much better on public broadcasting than we're doing.
But you don't think that people, if we got rid of public broadcasting and stopped funding it, people could just go online with their blogs and websites and replace it?
Because you can't build audience without marketing, without promoting, without reaching, readers and viewers. You can't, just by splintering the whole broadcasting system so everybody has their own website and talking to themselves, that's not a response to mass media, Fox News, the big American networks. We need to be able to have a voice heard in people's living rooms, where they are, where they watch television. And yes, television is changing. Yes, we could be more creative and inventive and all this. But the fight for public broadcasting is a fight for democracy. It's not just about broadcasting. It's about the people's right to know. That's why Free Press, which is leading this fight, is doing such a good job. It's so important. But I just feel we have to focus on more than just like knocking off a couple of right-wing politicians. I think we need to question where PBS is going and offer a vision for a different kind of public television that people can rally behind and support, because we need to know what we're for as well as what we're against.
Danny Schechter, the News Dissector. I hear the band tuning up in the background, which means it's time for us to clear out of the studio. We've only got about 15 seconds left. Danny, what is next on the itinerary for Danny Schechter? What are you working on in the coming weeks and months?
Three things. WMDthefilm.com. Check it out. If you haven't seen the movie, see it. I'm working on a new movie about credit and credit card debt. That's my next project. I have two books in the works, one, When News Lies, another, A Media Manifesto, which is my vision of what we need to do in the media system, how we can improve it. So I'm working on all of these issues and editing mediachannel.org, blogging every day, trying to keep this issue alive, and I'm really grateful To you for having me on. I really think your show does a great service.
Well, thank you, Danny Schechter. You've been a great guest as always. Keep up the great work. We'll talk to you soon. My name's Bob McChesney. I want to thank Andrew Boyle for doing a terrific job as producer. I'll be back in 167 hours with Dave Roediger. Until then, have a good week.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance. Private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events. Lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
This afternoon in Champaign-Urbana, partly sunny with a chance of showers and thunderstorms. The high around 90 degrees with southwest winds up to 10 miles per hour. Tonight, partly cloudy with the low in the lower 70s and southwest winds around 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow, partly sunny with a chance of showers and thunderstorms, the high in the upper 80s with southwest winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. You're listening to WILL Urbana, made possible by the support of our listeners, the friends of WILL. It's 2 p.m. A Prairie Home Companion is next.